Welcome to the Ringers Philly Special. Sheil Kapadia here. We had to record a segment for, you know, the local angle on FanDuel TV. Hopefully you guys check that out. But I was texting with Cliff and I thought, you know what? We might as well just do a mini pod. We were waiting and waiting last week saying, you know, when are we going to get to Eagle stuff? They didn't do anything. So we thought we would do a mini pod. All right. So where are the Eagles with their coaching search? You know, it's been a week ago after the Eagles lose that game against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. The question in the aftermath of that game was, will Nick Sirianni return as the Eagles head coach? And here we are a week later. And what's the biggest question around this Eagles team? It is Nick Sirianni still the Eagles head coach? So what do we know right now? We know that Nick Sirianni met with owner Jeffrey Lurie on Friday. We also know that none of the insiders, all the usual suspects with the Eagles, when they want to get their message out, they're using, you know, different methods to do that. Nothing against that. That's part of the business. No big deal. But no one has reported that Nick Sirianni is definitively coming back to coach the Philadelphia Eagles. Now, ESPN's Adam Schefter did say signs point to Sirianni staying, but that nothing was official and that talks were ongoing. So here's what I want to explore here a little bit. What are the possible reasons why we don't know definitively whether or not Nick Sirianni is returning as the Eagles head coach? Okay, so here are a couple theories I want to throw out there. Theory number one, you know, it's the old, like, the most straightforward one. And that's that Eagles owner Jeffrey Lurie has not decided yet whether Nick Sirianni will return as the Eagles head coach. Remember, I got to remind you of the history here, okay? Doug Peterson, 2020 season disaster. Doug Peterson holds a press conference at the end of the season talking about what the Eagles are going to do to fix this thing, to get it right. A week later, he's out of there. It was very clumsy. He held the press conference. Then he met with Jeffrey Lurie. Then Jeffrey Lurie decided he didn't like Doug Peterson's plan for the coaching staff. Doug Peterson sounded like, you know, maybe he had had enough, because remember, at that time, no one knew the direction of the franchise, and they just decided to move on. Eagles get into the coaching search late. They end up hiring Nick Sirianni. It's entirely possible that something like that is occurring again. You know, until I hear definitively that Sirianni is coming back, it could be that Lurie is still on the fence a little bit and wants to gather more information about whether keeping Sirianni is the right call. I've outlined it before. There are going to be things here that do not sit well with Jeffrey Lurie. Number one, the coaches and the job they did with the offensive talent on this football team. I mean, imagine Jeffrey Lurie watching these divisional round games, right? He's watching the Packers, where Matt LaFleur is just scheming guys wide open against the San Francisco 49ers. He's watching the Baltimore Ravens. Did you see this story? First half, they're getting blitzed by D'Amico Ryans over and over and over again. Weren't expecting it, because Texans are not a big blitz team. What do? Make adjustments. Todd Monken, the offensive coordinator, Lamar Jackson, they make adjustments. Second half, they come out, they score a bunch of touchdowns, and they put the Houston Texans away. Or how about the Detroit Lions? They look pretty buttoned up against the Tampa Bay Bucks, the team that made the Eagles look so silly last week. So you got all those things, and I wouldn't say any of those offenses are more talented than the Eagles. So that's not going to sit well with Jeffrey Lurie. That's one thing. Okay, another thing. I wrote my 11 rules for hiring an NFL head coach column on The Ringer. One of my big ones is, can the head coach put together a strong coaching staff? Can Sirianni do that? I mean, it didn't look like he could do it this year. Granted, we don't know exactly. You know, I know Howie Roseman, Jeffrey Lurie, those guys are involved in obviously putting together the coaching staff, but that was not a feather in Nick Sirianni's hat. So a couple things, you know, where Jeffrey Lurie could still be mulling this over. One, he probably knows I don't have a head coach who's a great offensive schemer. He's going to need some help there. Two, I don't have a head coach that necessarily is going to be able to put together this great coaching staff where I'm going to have schematic advantages week in and week out with the other people in the building. And number three, you got to look at it from a culture leadership perspective. I mean, it looked so bad the last 2 months here. We don't know what Nick Sirianni's relationship is with Jalen Hurts. Okay, Hurts certainly, I mean, he did not go to bat for Nick Sirianni at the end of the season. Now, maybe he feels like that's not his place or whatever, but, you know, whether you're reading something into that or not, go watch what Dak Prescott said about Mike McCarthy, for better or worse, you know, at the end of the season. It was much different than what Jalen Hurts said. So, Jeffrey Lurie is no dummy. Things are going, you know, there's going to be a lot of things that he's unhappy with about this football team. So that's theory number one, right? That's theory number one, that maybe he just hasn't decided. Okay, theory number two. You just don't need to announce that a coach is coming back. I'm telling you, beware of the spin here, Eagles fans. Okay, this is going to be the spin. If Nick Sirianni returns, the Eagles will say, and they'll get this message out to their various people in the media. They'll say, why would we announce something? Nick Sirianni, you don't announce when a coach is coming back. They'll say, the guy's been to the playoffs three straight seasons. He's won 67% of his games. He took us to the Super Bowl, for crying out loud, last year. They'll give other examples. Did the Rams announce that Sean McVay was coming back? Did the Steelers announce that Mike Tomlin was coming back? No, come on. We never needed to do that. We knew all along he was coming back. This was just a natural procedure. At the end of the season, you meet with people. That was never in question. What are you talking about? That's why we didn't announce everything. All right. I'm telling you all, everyone watching this, listening to this, that is garbanzo beans nonsense, and you should not believe it. Okay? I'm telling you from experience. I've covered this football team. The organization has rabbit ears. A lot of NFL organizations have rabbit ears. It's okay. They listen to what's being said. They react to it. They're kind of in their own bubble where everything feels, you know, like the biggest thing, regardless of what's happening in the world. They, you know, they hear, they listen, they read all those things. They get the narratives. What narratives are out there that we need to debunk? All those things. And so I just feel like if it were really the case that there was nothing to think about with Nick Sirianni, and this is just standard procedure at the end of the season, they would have leaked that to somebody like an Adam Schefter. They would have said, listen, this is off the record, but of course Nick Sirianni's coming back, okay? I mean, why wouldn't he be coming back? We're working through decisions on the rest of the coaching staff. We have nothing to announce there, but Nick Sirianni's job security was never in question. Don't be ridiculous. That's how it would have been handled, in my opinion. If there was zero doubt that Nick Sirianni was coming back, if this wasn't even a discussion, wasn't even a conversation, that is how the Philadelphia Eagles would have handled it. I mean, there's no benefit that I can think of. Maybe a listener, maybe, you know, one of you, a viewer, has something. I don't think there's any benefit for letting this just sort of hang in the wind for so long. Your head coach's job security. I mean, you squash that if there's no question, and you move on with the rest of your offseason. It's very easy to solve it that way. So I'm telling you, if you hear that spin, do not buy it, okay? This is not an easy slam dunk, no-brainer. Of course, Nick Sirianni's coming back decision. There were legitimate reasons to move on from Nick Sirianni. You know that. I know that. Jeffrey Lurie knows that, okay? So that's theory number two about why maybe we haven't heard anything so far. Okay, theory number three. This is the last one. Maybe they just want to settle things with the rest of the staff. You know, Brian Johnson has interviewed for some head coaching jobs, their offensive coordinator. If he gets hired, Eagles get draft pick compensation. Obviously, it's just a bad look to fire a guy who's up for head coaching jobs. And also, they want the draft pick compensation. So it's this bizarre spot where you might be thinking about moving on from a guy, and other teams might be thinking about hiring him and promoting him from where he is right now. So I understand why you would not want to make that move right now, not want to get that leaked right now. That is a bad look for you if you're an organization. Now, defensively, hilarious move on Sunday where they it gets reported that Sean Desai has been fired. I almost fell on the floor. I was shocked by this news, you know, a week into not knowing whether the head coach is staying, and then you get a little breadcrumb that Sean Desai's not going to be. I forgot. He wasn't already fired. He was upstairs doodling during the games from the coach's box. So that was leaked right before Bills Chiefs. Sorry, not leaked, reported right before Bills Chiefs. So I thought that was hilarious. So they fired him, but they didn't fire him. His title was still defensive coordinator, and now, yes, they are actually firing him. So maybe with the coordinator stuff, maybe with the coaches, maybe they're still working out. Who do we want to bring in? Who do we want to let go? Let's not announce anything. I'm sorry. I don't buy that theory either. You easily can say, again, to your chosen reporter that Nick Sirianni's not going anywhere, but discussions about the staff are ongoing. We're not telling you anything else about the staff right now. You don't have to send out a press release. Again, you can just, you know, you're in contact constantly. The higher-ups in the Eagles organization are in contact constantly with the insiders around the NFL, with various members of the media. And so you can get that out there very easily that Nick Sirianni is not going anywhere, but there might be changes with the coaching staff. We're not telling you about any of those. So those are, I think, the various theories about what's going on with the Philadelphia Eagles right now. And I guess the one I didn't mention is this could just be clumsy. I mean, there really could be like no real reason for it. Jeffrey Lurie could have met with Nick Sirianni. He could have decided he's coming back, and they just could be handling this in a very awkward, clumsy situation. That has happened before. I've said it before. NFL organizations are not well-oiled machine. So that's kind of my take on what's going on with the Philadelphia Eagles right now. Okay, let's take a break.
Around the corner, we've got Off the Pipe. Yeah, hitting you up with everything for the Boston fans out there. We got Celtics talk. Of course, they're beating everybody at home. And Gerard Mayo stirring things up as a new England Patriots football coach. That's coming up right here on the Local End.
Brian Barrett from Off the Pike. So the Mayo era is underway for the Patriots, and it felt like the Bill Belichick era was about to start for the Falcons, but maybe we jumped a little bit too soon on that one, because we found out on Thursday that Bill Belichick flew in Arthur Blank's private jet to interview again with the Atlanta Falcons. And at that particular point in time, I don't know about you, but I sure felt like, okay, this is a done deal. It was being proposed as Bill's second interview, but I thought at the time this was more like, hey, Bill Belichick is interviewing the Falcons, not the other way around, right? This is the greatest coach in the history of the league. He's interviewing them. They're not interviewing him. If he wants this job, this is his. So, and I also felt at the beginning of the process, we got the reporting that Atlanta, their number one target was Bill Belichick. And remember, it had been all over the place that the Falcons really wanted Bill Belichick. And from my perspective, I never thought it was the greatest fit. But after you go through the jobs, and I'll get to that in a second here, you felt like, okay, maybe he ends up in Atlanta. And after he has that second interview, you feel like, okay, this is a done deal. But then we find out on Sunday, there's a lot more to this Falcons situation. Harbaugh is going to have a second interview with them. Mike Vrabel is going to be interviewing with the Falcons. Joe Brady is going, and that's not a big deal. I mean, he's the offensive coordinator for the Bills. I don't see that one as like a threat to Belichick. Brian Callahan, the offensive coordinator for the Bengals. You have Bobby Slowick, the offensive coordinator for the Texans. So Adam Schefter reports that the search is, quote, a wide net in terms of the job that Atlanta has right now. So if you're the Falcons and you can talk to Jim Harbaugh and Mike Vrabel, you do it, right? Jim Harbaugh went to the conference title game with the San Francisco 49ers, what, three straight years, and he made it to a Super Bowl. He got Alex Smith to play at a high level before then they develop Colin Kaepernick, and he becomes a stud for a couple of years. Remember, Alex Smith was considered to be an afterthought, a bust with the number one overall pick, and Harbaugh got his career on track. So most recently, of course, we all know, three straight trips to the college football playoff, and he just won the national championship, right? So if I'm making a coaching decision at this point in time and Harbaugh wants to be my head coach, I'm sorry, I would go with Harbaugh over Bill. He's 60 years old. Bill's 71. Belichick's coming off two horrible seasons, and Jim Harbaugh's coming off a national championship. And I get it. You could say, hey, there's issues there in terms of violating rules. Okay, yeah, but it's college football. It's not like he's going to have these issues in the NFL. I don't think he's going to have another situation that he had this past season at Michigan. He's a great coach despite having a track record with some issues, right? So anyway, if I was Atlanta, Harbaugh's there, I would hire Harbaugh, but it doesn't feel like that's totally going to be the case, right? The question is, does Harbaugh really want that gig? Now, Harbaugh to the Chargers has always made the most sense, right? Gets back to California, where, of course, he coached at San Diego, he coached at Stanford, he coached the San Francisco 49ers, right? So outside of Michigan, he's spent most of his coaching career in the state of California. And you also have a really talented quarterback in Justin Herbert, and he can be the final piece, can Harbaugh, to sort of save that organization that's been, quite frankly, run very poorly. And that sounds a lot like San Francisco before he got to San Francisco. So Harbaugh wins that battle with Bill if he wants to go to Atlanta, but it feels like the Chargers have always made more sense for Harbaugh. But now Harbaugh is at least part of the conversation if he's having another interview. And then the other guy there is Mike Vrabel. He's just 48. And we know the Chargers have interest in Vrabel. The Seahawks have interest in Vrabel. And look, these other guys, Callahan, Slowick, I just can't see that for Atlanta. Because, and look, they may turn out to be great coaches, especially Bobby Slowick. I love that guy from the Houston Texans. But the point with that is, it feels like what Atlanta wants is an experienced coach. That's why I sort of rule those guys out. But to me, the one thing I'll say is this. If you look at the other openings right now, the Commanders I have first, like if you're ranking the best jobs, because you have a new ownership group that is really motivated and you get rid of the worst owner in the NFL, you have the number two overall pick. So you're going to have your choice whether you like Drake May or Jaden Daniels. And the coach going there is going to have a long rope because they know they're in a rebuild, right? They've identified that. They bring in Adam Peters, who was second in command over there in San Francisco. So you have a high level of executive hire already, too. They're into analytics over there. So that's a really good job. Number two, I would have the Chargers. Then I would have Atlanta. And the reason I put the Chargers over Atlanta is because they have Herbert, right? Then you have Seattle, I would put after that. Then Tennessee and Carolina. So here's the problem that Bill has that Harbaugh and Mike Vrabel don't. Those guys have other options, right? And because of what Bill is looking for and what teams are looking for, and because the Cowboys stuck with McCarthy, and because the Eagles appear that, hey, we're just going to switch up our coaching staff and stick with Sirianni, Atlanta is the only real job that links up for Belichick because it feels like the Chargers are more intrigued with Harbaugh than Belichick, right? Belichick wanted an underachieving but talented team. And you think about this, the only two teams that fit that are the Chargers and the Falcons because those other teams are not firing their coaches. Carolina's a dumpster fire that drafted the wrong quarterback. Bill's not going there. Tennessee is now going through a rebuild. Seattle just got rid of its older coach. So Belichick's not going there. So the Vrabel-Harbaugh wrinkle in this makes this whole situation just a little bit cloudier for Bill Belichick. So if you're in the Belichick camp, you have to be hoping that Vrabel gets the Commanders job and Harbaugh takes the Chargers job because that gives you the path to Atlanta. Now, Washington is sort of a wild card in all this, right? I mentioned Vrabel, the possibility of him going to the Commanders, and Adam Peters was working with the Patriots when Vrabel was a player, so there is a connection there. But they're into analytics, as I mentioned. They may want to go with a young offensive mind to mold their young quarterback, whoever they take at number two. And you also think about it from Peters' perspective. He comes from San Francisco, where all these great offensive guys come from, right? Kyle Shanahan's coaching tree, Mike McDaniel with the Miami Dolphins. You think about it, they may look at it and say, hey, maybe we want an offensive guy, not Mike Vrabel, a defensive guy. So that's what Washington is one to watch out for here, right? So I've always felt Atlanta for Belichick was sort of boring. But now I'm anxious because I just want Bill to get a head coaching job, but it really feels like this is the only one for Belichick, unless something wild happens with the Chargers and Harbaugh. So this is the question that I would ask. Bill clearly wants to get right back into this thing, and he's motivated to do so. But could a lack of patience actually hurt Bill Belichick here? And this is what I mean by that. So we've talked about the Belichick without Tom Brady narrative, where I felt like for a while it was kind of stupid, but now after this track record of the last four seasons, it is something that Bill, when he coaches, wherever he coaches again, he's going to have to prove it wrong because we know the record in Cleveland was not good. It was 36-44. We know that Bill's coming off a 4-13 season, the worst of his time here with the Patriots, and that was after an 8-9 season. So this Atlanta thing on paper, it looks good, right? Because it's a winnable division, right? And that's certainly the case. And I look at around the league, like I said, I would have moved on from Mike McCarthy and Nick Sirianni. And if both those teams underachieve again, here's the thing. Like, the Atlanta situation looks good now, but what if next offseason Mike McCarthy gets fired? Which is incredibly possible because in all likelihood, the Cowboys are going to choke again. What if Sirianni and the Eagles underachieve? Those jobs could come open, right? But I threw out this possibility last week on the pod that, okay, the quarterback that makes the most sense and that Belichick could win with in Atlanta and is actually realistic to get is Kirk Cousins because he's a free agent. But even that's not a lock, right? Because Cousins may just go back to Minnesota or he may go elsewhere, right? And I know, like, his wife's from Georgia. We got that. We talked about that last week in the pod as well. So maybe that's a connection, but there's no guarantee he's going to go there. And also, you look at the fact that, so if it's not Cousins who can get you to the playoffs, the eighth pick, you don't really have a good situation there in terms of getting the quarterback. So when you look at it from that perspective, it just feels like if you go there, if you're Bill Belichick, you go to Atlanta and you have a few seasons where you're under 500, the you cannot win without Tom narrative gets louder and louder. And with Brady, the difference here is he was the final piece to the puzzle in Tampa. Obviously, the most important piece, but that team had so much talent. You had a great slot receiver in Chris Godwin. You had Mike Evans, who has been one of the best receivers in the NFL for now a decade. And then he brought his buddy Gronk out of retirement with him. The defense was already stacked. We're talking about Lavonte David, Devin White. You had Vita Vea. So, and you look at that group in Tampa the previous season, Jameis Winston, yes, he threw the 30 interceptions, but he also threw 30 touchdowns. Like, they had weapons and they had a lot to work with there. So even though Tom, we all know that he wanted to go to San Francisco and play for his childhood team, the reality for Tom is he actually chose really well. Now, San Francisco, it would have been great there. And remember, famously, they went back and they watched all the film and they decided that Jimmy Garoppolo was a better option than Tom Brady, which is just thinking back how ridiculous that sounds. But that was their logic because, of course, Tom's numbers were not particularly good in the 2019 season when he didn't have the weapons and he didn't have the offensive line protection. Remember, that was a tough season for the Patriots. But anyway, just getting back to my point here is I understand the urgency with Belichick that he's so motivated. He wants to prove Kraft wrong. He wants to get back into it right now. But I just don't see like this clear path with Atlanta. And I do wonder, sometimes it feels like, hey, maybe if you take a step back and you wait a year, these other job opportunities open up for you. Now, I was under the impression late last week that, hey, this is just going to be Bill's job and he's going to be able to go to Atlanta and be the head coach. But now that there's just a little bit more competition for this, it does make it a little bit more difficult. And I really do start to think to myself, hey, I really don't want to see Bill go somewhere else and stink, right? Because we saw him over the past couple of years. Now, what's hurt Bill more than anything else, we've been over it time and time again, has been the actual roster construction, not the coaching. Belichick can still coach. But if he goes to this place and they don't get the quarterback situation right, well, he's with the Patriots again, right? With a slightly better roster. Like, I know Atlanta has weapons and all that, but it would feel like Bill's coaching the Patriots again if he doesn't have a legitimate quarterback. So right now, it's going to be fascinating to see how this thing sort of turns out. But I'm now starting to get a little bit worried about the Belichick to Atlanta situation.
Next up, John Yastrzemski, and of course, the New York folks. Gotta love JJ. He's talking Knicks. He's talking Yankees. He's talking everything New York. And of course, he'll slip some Dolphins talk in there for you as well. John Yastrzemski and the New York crew coming up next right here on The Local Angle.
To The Local Angle here on FanDuel TV. I'm JJ John Yastrzemski, the host of New York, New York. And we don't cover the Buffalo Bills because even though they play in the state of New York, listen, we have two teams in the metropolitan tri-state area that happen to play in the state of New Jersey, but you get my drift. The Jets and the Giants are our teams. And if you want to go do a podcast in Western New York and you want Simmons to go and hire you, then maybe you'll get weekly day-to-day breakdowns on the Buffalo Bills. But there was a great analogy as I sat down and I watched all these NFL playoff games and we did a bunch of shows on Ringer Wise guys on Saturday and Sunday with the whole crew like we do each and every week. My esteemed colleague and my good friend, Raheem Palmer, I thought had the perfect analogy in comparing what has transpired over the last 5 years between the Buffalo Bills and the Kansas City Chiefs. And if you think about the history of this rivalry, yeah, it probably goes back to the 2020 season, the first time they matched up in an AFC title game. Chiefs laid the smackdown. We had the epic 13-second game a few years ago. And there have been a whole lot of classics between the Bills and the Chiefs. There's no getting around that. But my pal Raheem Palmer went on Ringer Wise Guys earlier on Sunday and mentioned, and I couldn't believe he did it, and it made me absolutely sick to my stomach. And those of you who know my New York ties and know my New York twang and feel and emotion and everything that comes with it, my buddy Dream struck a nerve in basically bringing out the Michael Jordan, Patrick Ewing, Bulls, Knicks comparison of what happened in the early and mid-1990s when the Knicks had some outstanding regular seasons, the Knicks had some outstanding teams, but if Michael Jordan was standing in their way, there was no way in the world they were beating Michael Jordan. Well, sure enough, the Buffalo Bills, with home field advantage on their side, with Kansas City probably having the worst offensive team they have had in the Mahomes era, they still find a way to go into Western New York and break the hearts of all the Buffalo Bills fans. And let's be real about this game. It was classic. It was back and forth. It was super entertaining. It was the game of the postseason. The Buffalo Bills were handed every break imaginable in this game. Mecole Hardman was a jet for 5 minutes. Pacheco's running like and man possessed. He's running it down the Buffalo Bills' throats, and yet you're running a trick play in which he fumbles it out of the end zone, Hardman. Inexcusable from Andy Reid. How about the Josh Allen fumble that the Kansas City Chiefs late in the game try to scoop and score? You get two breaks like that. You may be thinking, and I know I was watching this game live, maybe, just maybe, the Buffalo Bills are going to be on the right side of this thing. And this is coming from somebody who took Kansas City plus the 2.5 today on Ringer Wise Guys. I was on the Chiefs today. But as I'm watching this game unfold, I'm like, wow, all the breaks, all the Uncle Mo is on the side of Buffalo. Everything's going their way. Until that final possession right after the 2-minute warning. Josh Allen missing wide open receivers, forcing the issue down the field, making ill-advised choices on second and third down, respectively, putting the Bills in a spot where they had to settle for a 40-something yard field goal on a freezing cold, blustery day. When you put yourself in that position with a kicker that you can't really trust, you get what you deserve. And the Buffalo Bills, once again, get what they deserve. I know a lot of the people are going to be saying, oh, wide right again. The crying Bills fans in the stands. Oh, a kicker again. No, 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 no. This is not about your place kicker. Your offense had three possessions in the fourth quarter. They couldn't go and get a touchdown with multiple chances. Couldn't do it. Got multiple breaks. Got the game at home. And yet still couldn't beat the Kansas City Chiefs. Now, I'm always very hesitant in proclaiming, oh, this is the Bills' last shot. They got a quarterback who's, you know, in his late 20s. Josh Allen's not going anywhere. Josh Allen is still one of the premier talents at the position he plays. But is there something lacking at the end of these games from a football IQ standpoint compared to Mahomes? Yeah, there absolutely is. And you're never going to have the utmost faith and confidence that Josh Allen can go and beat Patrick Mahomes in a big situation until he actually proves he can go and slay the beast. He's now 0-3 in games that really count and games that really matter against Mahomes. So more anguish, more heartbreak, and a Knicks-Bulls analogy that I never in a million years thought I'd have to deal with here going into Championship Sunday. And listen, to get the 1 and the 3 and to get the 1 and the 2, kind of in many ways what you would have expected. Bills-Chiefs was a toss-up. Game could have gone either way. You fully expected Baltimore to go and take care of Houston. Tight for a half. Everyone had their narrative. Oh, Lamar can't win a playoff game. Lamar can't win a big one. He came out firing in the second half. The Ravens ran it right down the Texans' throat. and their defense stifled C.J. Stroud every which way. So Kansas City-Baltimore is the main event. Even though it will be the first game of Championship Sunday, cannot wait to watch that game. You'll have to stay tuned for my pick, which will be coming up later on in the week on Ringer Wise Guys. Then you will have the feel-good Detroit Lions, who win by 8 over Tampa, who explode in the second half, attacking the middle of the field with LaPorta and Gibbs and St. Brown and Reynolds. Goff, fantastic. Lions now, almost a touchdown underdog against Purdy and the Niners, who survived. That's the best way to put it, against Jordan Love and the Green Bay Packers. It was not a great game from Purdy. The Niner clock management at the end of the first half was abominable. The missed field goal was key. The Niners relied on their bell cow. Sometimes in these big games, you got to go and stick with the girl or the partner that brought you to the dance. That's Christian McCaffrey in this case. McCaffrey would not let the Niners lose at the end of that game. And Jordan Love was terrible in the second half. As good as Jordan Love was in the game a week ago against the Dallas Cowboys, that's how lousy he was in the second half of this game against San Francisco. And part of me wonders with this game. I know a lot of people are going to want to pick the Lions. A lot of people are going to question Brock Purdy. That's all fair. That's all well and good. I kind of wonder if the Niners had their scare a week ago in the divisional round. And we got to see on Deebo Samuel. We'll see how it all shakes out. But I think you're going to get a much sharper and a much crisper performance out of the Niners, who have a chance to get back to the Super Bowl for the first time since that game against the Chiefs in Miami right before the start of the pandemic. Wouldn't it be something if we had the Chiefs and the Niners yet again, but this time in Las Vegas, swapping out Garoppolo, swapping out Tyreek Hill, and in comes Brock Purdy, and in comes Taylor Swift. You know, that's the matchup that CBS and company are drooling for. I'd be A-okay with Ravens-Niners. Hey, I'd be A-okay with Ravens and Lions, but that one's not as good for my future portfolio. Just throwing that one out there. So we got all that going on with Championship Sunday, and we had a little homecoming at Madison Square Garden on Saturday night because R.J. Barrett and Emmanuel Quickley played their first games at the Garden wearing the other team's uniform. And you knew the Garden faithful was going to salute Emmanuel Quickley. They were going to salute R.J. Barrett, and rightfully so. These are guys that had sensational, feel-good moments in a Nick uniform. You know, people are going to say, well, Barrett didn't live up to the number three pick. Yeah, that might be true. He outplayed Donovan Mitchell in a playoff series. Emmanuel Quickley was a candidate for sixth man of the year just a season ago. The Knicks are better off with the trade they've made. They are better off with OJ Anunoby. But I fully expected that the Knicks fan would go and salute two guys that kind of gave it their all at Madison Square Garden. It was fun to watch. It was also fun to watch Jalen Brunson go and work his magic. And he's my favorite Knicks since Patrick Ewing. And I'm a Syracuse guy, and I'm a Carmelo Anthony fan. I am not a Carmelo Anthony hater. Jalen Brunson's style of basketball is just so easy on the eyes. Makes everybody better. He, as a player, it feels like gets better. Game by game, year by year. You look at that contract now for Brunson. He's criminally underpaid. And to think, some wondered if it was going to be an overpay, myself included. How silly were we? Jalen Brunson's one of the 20, 25 best players in the NBA. And when we're sitting here in the middle of February and I'm on a safari in South Africa during the All-Star weekend, Jalen Brunson's going to be at the game. You can make an argument Jalen Brunson should be starting for the Eastern Conference in the All-Star game. That's how terrific he has been all season long. So he put on a show on Saturday night. The Knicks laid the smackdown against the Raptors, and those are two teams kind of headed in different directions. Raptors clearly retooling, and the Knicks trying to figure out what's next. Waiting on news with Hartenstein and his injury. They need help from the guard spot. Maybe a guy like Bruce Brown, who's in Toronto as we speak. Maybe he fits the team. We shall see. But good homecoming, good ovation, but business taken care of from a Knicks perspective. And that business of making sure they're in that top five, I think, is oh so important between now and the end of this year. All right. Before we say goodbye here on The Local Angle, Jeff Money, who is a regular on our podcast, he joins us on the show and gives us a pick or two. So, Jeff Money, it's a Monday, no football. What do we got?
What up, JJ? Jeff Money here with a handicapper pick. It'll be for a Monday. We've got a little college basketball action. prediction, I'm going to go with a dog. I'm going to go with Wake Forest plus the 8.5 over North Carolina. So we're going to roll with Wake Forest plus the 8.5, and everyone can follow all my daily plays on Twitter at Jeff Money. Okay, JJ, I'm out of here. Let's go.
You know, I like that play, Jeff Money. Wake Forest needs a signature win. Carolina, 15-3 on the year. I know they're playing like a number one seed. I know they're playing some top-notch basketball. But this is a point in the season where these teams trying to make their play for the NCAA tournament can be live going into these situations. So I would absolutely grab the 8.5 with the Demon Deacons. That's the line at the moment. I also am looking at Kansas. Kansas off the loss over the weekend. Look for them in a good bounce back spot against Cincinnati. The line opened at 7. You can find it at FanDuel right now at 9. I think you're going to get a monster bounce back. I know Kansas has been reeling a little bit. The title odds have actually diminished quite a bit. You can get them in the 20-1 range. Maybe a good buy low spot for self and the Jayhawks. Something I'll be thinking about between now and Monday. But I do like them to go and respond against the Cincinnati Bearcats. So a couple of college basketball plays before we say goodbye.
Welcome into the Local Angle. I am Jason Goff, and of course, this is FanDuel TV. Shout out to all our FanDuel TV people, and of course, you can catch us here on the Full Go every Sunday, every Tuesday, and every Thursday, unless there's an emergency pod for us to drop. Of course, we're presented to you by FanDuel. Ringer is the family, and of course, Spotify is the gang. And I have the pleasure to be joined by Chicago and National Radio Giant, ladies and gentlemen. He's been in the business for a while, been doing it at a high level for a while. He is not only a colleague, he is a friend as well. You can catch him from 10 to 2 p.m. every single weekday here in the city of Chicago on 670 The Score. He is none other than the Lawrence Holmes part of the Bernstein and Holmes show. What's up, Lawrence? How you doing, brother?
Jay, thank you for having me here on the Local Angle on the Full Go. You know, I'm a P1 listener to this podcast, so anytime I can be a visitor, I love it. And, you know, I'm a FanDuel guy, too. So it all works out.
Shout out to FanDuel. You know, when the casual betting brothers get together and Lawrence Holmes gets together, then you never know how much money you might win. We might give you a little something at the end of this thing. We're supposed to be giving a local angle, right? But I'll talk to you in pod about the South Loop move for the Chicago White Sox, what's going on with the Bulls and some other things. But I want to get to what we learned about the Bears. And you might say, hey, Goff, the Bears haven't played football for a couple of weeks. Well, you can still learn something about your football team, especially when teams in the division are making the hay that the Detroit Lions and before they got ousted, the Green Bay Packers were making. Lawrence, I've been trying this season, especially and over this last couple of weeks, to figure out where football not only is going, but also the entertainment value that is locked in intrinsically because of the gambling and betting aspect and the fantasy football aspect, but the homogenization of the game. And we've talked about on these last couple of pods how seemingly everybody's trying to do the same thing, but with varying pieces. And we got a chance on this evening that we're taping to see Pat Mahomes and Josh Allen go at it in Kansas City and Buffalo. And one team ran the football well and another team didn't. One team was able to move people out of the way and the other team had a quarterback who was running into people for most of the game. So I ask you this, before we even get into the Justin Fields, Caleb Williams, who's the next offensive coordinator thing, what do you think Bears fans and the Bears organization should and can take away from not only the successes of the teams that are in the division with them, but what championship football is kind of playing out to be this season?
I've been talking over the last couple of weeks, Jay, about the idea that taking the North and never giving it back has never felt so far away, right? Because you're not doing this in a vacuum. Like, this isn't just the Bears worrying about the Bears. They have to worry about this while it looks like Detroit is exactly where they want to be and Green Bay is starting to move to where they want to be. So you've got to run even faster to try and catch up. It's like you're running the last leg of a relay and they've got a 50 meter lead on you already and you're trying to get there. So it becomes difficult, man. I've been fighting the fight. I mean, at least I've been trying to on the radio show over the last, I would say, my God, like the last maybe 3 months of trying to explain to everyone that it's not all side, everything fits. Like you have to figure out what you have and then kind of work around it. When you look around the NFL, there's all sorts of different ways to win. I heard you and Alex talking about it on the pod, about the idea of there is still the element of can you block and can you tackle? And if you can still do those things, no matter what your scheme is on offense, you can have success. I'm fascinated by it. Like if I decide to go get a PhD, well, one of the things that I think I would even start to work on is the idea of quarterback development and how it's different from team to team, from organization to organization, kind of what they value. I look at the coaches that are moving on, whether they're retiring or being forced to retire. And I look at Pete Carroll and what he did for Geno Smith. Just by, I remember the interview, it was great. Geno Smith was talking about how Pete Carroll was the first coach as a pro that told him to stop bad talking himself. That Geno had been out here and been like, oh, you know, he misses a play in practice. You know, I'm trash. I'm this, I'm that. And Pete Carroll was the first coach to be like, why do you do that? And Geno kind of had to have this introspective moment of, why do I do that? I'm not going to do that anymore. These are the things that I'm wondering about, like the nature versus nurture part of it. And when I look at just the two teams in the division, when I'm looking at the Bears, I'm seeing a guy who has improved mid-career. Like it's had a renaissance similar, and I was talking about it on Twitter, similar to what Baker Mayfield has done this season and what Geno Smith is. I don't think either, I don't think Goff, Baker, or Geno are great. Mm-hmm. I do think that all three of those guys are capable of winning you. And clearly with this playoffs, we've seen that at least two of those guys are capable of winning you playoff games. The question becomes, if you don't have great, if you don't have legendary at the quarterback position, what do you do to try to win, or do you wait? And then you say, well, we think this guy is great, without actually having proof that the guy is great. And then you have to kind of start the cycle all over again. The whole thing to me is really, really fascinating. But I'll tell you, when I look at Jordan Love, and I remember it was midway through the season, I was talking with Dave Wanstead about this, and it was a game that he had played poorly. It may have been the Raiders game that they played. And I said, you know, I get it now with Jordan Love. Sure, he played badly, but I saw some of the throws that he can make, and I get why anyone who would see him would go, oh yeah, that's a guy that you can, you know, win some games with. And then he went on that stretch where I think it was like 24 touchdowns and one interception over the last nine games, and you start to go, oh no, like the Packers may have again found that guy. Yeah. And when you watch him play, especially after watching him this past weekend, you realize that he's got a little bit of Rodgers and a little bit of Favre in him. And that's both good and bad. But it's real bad for the Bears, because even at this point, you could make the argument that depending on who the quarterback is in Minneapolis, that they're still the fourth best team in the division. There's a lot of room for them left to grow.
In the AFC for the next 5, 6, 7 years, somebody out of Joe Burrow, Lamar Jackson, Pat Mahomes, and Josh Allen, one of them ain't making the Pro Bowl. Does that mean that they ain't the guy? No. That means that somebody on their team made plays to help them, that everything wasn't on them. The Baltimore Ravens are the best team in football, seemingly, and I put Lamar Jackson stats up if we went shadow profiles, and you'd be like, all right, give me that guy. Give me Josh Allen, or give me Joe Burrow. No, give me Lamar Jackson for the compliment that a number one quarterback can be at times. And I think that's some of the situations that we haven't had to digest here in this city, because we've never had to thoroughly go through a quarterback development. Like, I'd be interested to see, Lawrence, how and what we learn from what just happened these last 3 years with Justin Fields.
Well, that's the one good part, is that if they decide to move on from him, then you have like a body of work that the Bears front office can then use to figure out if they're going to draft Caleb Williams or Jaden Daniels or Drake May. and say, okay, what do they take away from the experience of Justin Fields? And sure, they came in late to this process with him, but maybe it isn't. Maybe it's making sure that you match an offensive coordinator with what the quarterback is able to do. This is another part of like the thesis thing that if I go through with it, that I'm fascinated by. There's still enough coaches who were brought up by other coaches who don't think that a running quarterback is a good idea. There's still enough of that influence in the league that there's, I mean, we hear it in the dialogue with fans all the time. We heard the ridiculous statement from someone earlier, 2 weeks ago, talking about how Lamar isn't, the tropes that are thrown out about, well, he's a good running back, but maybe right. not a quarterback. And you know what's wild? I'm sitting here watching reels while, you know, in commercial break, and I see Tom Brady talking with Lamar Jackson and him beaming about Lamar Jackson, seeing two guys whose games are pretty different, having an appreciation for the other guy's game and what it means. So I hope that what the Bears take from all of this is there's different ways to go about it. And I don't know if this is the right call to stay with Eberflus. I probably lean towards they should have fired him just because it would have given you more opportunities to talk to different people. And he's probably about replacement level or a little bit better than replacement level or a little bit worse, depending on your point of view.
Right.
But the cool thing about what's happening in the division is with LaFleur, you have, here's the guy with the crazy offensive scheme that knows how to coach quarterbacks and can run the offense the way that he wants. Blah, 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 blah. In Detroit, you have, here's the snarling ex-player guy.
Right.
That's out here putting together an incredible staff, getting support, and winning the cult of personality. And what it shows is I get really angry when people talk in absolutes about, well, your head coach has to be an offensive guru. Okay. I think that you're probably mostly right about that. But explain Dan Campbell then. Explain D'Amico Ryans to me. And to me, it's more about, can you lead? We continue to not think of the head coaching job as a different skill set than being a coordinator.
Right.
It's a completely different
right.
job
right.
than being a play caller.
CFO and CEO are two different gigs.
Yes. Yes. And part of, I mean, one of the knocks I think against Matt Eberflus is you look at the people that he hired and you go, that's not really head coaching. Like, you hired a bad staff, whether we're talking about guys that were pushed out because they were out here doing crazy stuff inside the building, or the fact that I'm convinced, Jay, that Matt Eberflus likes Justin Fields.
That wraps it up for us right here on The Local Angle. We will see you next week. Same time, same place right here on FanDuel TV.